got a quorum. Why don't we, let's go ahead and call the roll.
The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Good morning, Chair Fletcher and Board. This is Sharon Cooney. I'm going to turn it over to the clerk to go ahead and call the roll.
Aguirre?
Here.
Arambula? Campbell?
Here.
Fletcher?
Fletcher here.
Frank?
Here.
Galvez?
Galvez here.
Hall?
Hall here.
McClellan? Montgomery?
Here.
Moreno?
Moreno here.
Salas?
Salas here.
Sankey?
Sankey here.
Sotelo Solis?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Ward? All right. Thank you. I will mute my phone.
Ward?
Here.
Weber?
Here.
Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. I want to thank all the board members for being here. With that, we will officially call to order the October 15th meeting of the MTS Board of Directors. Just quickly, we have a couple reasonably lengthy presentation items. We have one item on here that we're going to get to that we need to approve. We will do that first, then we'll go into the report items. We do have a couple closed session items. They should be very quick, but there are some time sensitivities. And so we may, at some point, if we can't get through the presentations, we may break, adjourn into closed session and address those issues. I would think if we're not, say, wrapping up by 11:15-ish, then we probably will break. I know some of you have a hard stop around noon, but we will see if we can power through and get through this. So with that, agenda item two is approval of the minutes. September 17th, 2020 meeting. I will make a motion to approve. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. We have a second. All in second by Mr. Hall. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. We will now move to agenda item three, public comment. I'll ask the clerk if there are any requests to speak in public comment.
Chair, we have one speaker, Janelle Sisting, but it doesn't seem like they're on.
Okay. If they come back on, please let us know and we can certainly take them at the end of the meeting. With no requests to speak, we'll now move to the consent calendar. I'll first ask if any board members have any items that they would like to pull on the consent calendar or questions to ask. Right. Hearing none, I will ask the clerk if there are any items the public wishes to pull.
None, Chair.
All right, hearing none, I'll make a motion to approve the consent calendar. Is there a second to that motion?
Sankey, second.
Second by Council Member Sankey. With that, will all in favor say aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right, that motion carries. With that, we'll move right into discussion item 30. This is our fiscal year 2020 final budget comparison. There's some actions we need to take around some reserves. I want to thank Mayor Salas, who chairs our budget subcommittee. Budget subcommittee had a lengthy meeting on this topic, asked a lot of good questions, and has brought before the board here a unanimous recommendation. But of course, we want to walk through the presentation with the full board, have a chance for discussion, questions, any input, and then certainly get the board's direction for how we move forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to staff for their budget presentation.
Good morning. My name is Gordon Meyer. I'm the operating budget supervisor here at MTS. This morning, we are going to cover the final budget results, the operating budget results for fiscal year 2020. So first off, I did want to remind everyone that the FY20 amended budget did include $33.5 million of projected CARES Act funding, and this projected funding was to cover revenue losses and increased expenses resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic. So as you'll see on the upcoming slides, we did have favorable budget results in FY20, meaning that we needed less CARES Act funding to bridge the gap for this fiscal year. But I do want to point out that we do have a structural deficit that is very real that we'll get into on later slides. But because we used less CARES Act funding this year to bridge the deficit, that means we have more available for FY21 and out years where these structural deficits are projected to be much higher. So getting into the numbers, so for our operating revenues, on the first line we have fare revenue. So here we finished the fiscal year 20 favorable to budget by $3.2 million or 4.2%. So fare revenue was unfavorable to the prior year by $12.7 million or 13.8%. Ridership during that same period was unfavorable by 14.1 million passengers to the prior year or 16.6%. So the next line, we have our other operating revenue. So we finished the fiscal year here favorable by $3.1 million or 16.5%. And the primary driver here was that the decreases to our energy credit, interest, advertising, and rental income was lower than we had projected. So we had assumed a $2 million decrease due to COVID, and we actually ended the year very close to our original pre-COVID budget here, so that $2 million was a favorable figure. The other driver for other operating revenue was that the county rental payment for the Mills building rent was higher than what was included in the budget. That rent calculation had changed after the Mills building final debt payment was made, and the operating budget did not reflect that revised calculation. So moving on to expenses. So personnel costs, we finished the year $4.9 million favorable to budget or 3.4%. This was primarily driven by favorable paid absences. So we had included $2.9 million in additional budget for COVID-specific paid absences. And what we didn't know when we were developing the budget was that there was going to be a federal program called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And this program actually ended up paying directly for these COVID-specific paid absences. So that $2.9 million was a pickup and a favorable variance. In personnel, we also had favorable health and welfare costs, operator wages due to reduced service levels, and favorable cost recovery. The next line, we have our purchase transportation. So that's our TransDev and our first transit contracts. So here we ended the year favorable just under $2 million or 2.6%. And that was primarily driven by reduced service levels between April and June in response to the pandemic. Next, we have our other outside services. So here we were favorable a little over $1 million or 3.3% for the year. And this was primarily within administration, specifically our IT, ballot measures, security, and marketing. And then we also had favorable engines and transmission overhaul costs within our bus divisions. Next, we have energy costs. Here we ended favorable $253,000 or 0.8%. That was driven by favorable CNG, diesel, and gas consumption, partially offset by unfavorable electricity expenses due to higher than projected rates. And then lastly, we have other expenses where we were unfavorable $961,000 or 3.6%. This was primarily due to an unfavorable one-time legal settlement within our risk department. And this was partially offset by favorable experience in IT, credit card fees, and fare materials. So all in all, our operating expenses were favorable by $7.2 million or 2.3%. So when we look at the operating activities combined, our operating revenues were favorable by $6.3 million, and our operating expenses were favorable by $7.2 million, resulting in a combined favorable net operating variance of $13.5 million or 6.3%. So we covered the operating activities, that are part of the operating budget. The other major component of our operating budget is the non-operating activities or our subsidy revenue. So before we jump into the actual numbers here, I did want to give a brief overview of the categories that make up our subsidy revenue budget. So first, we have our federal revenues. So this includes our recurring FTA funds for preventive maintenance and rural operations. Specifically, that's our FTA 5307, 5337, and 5311 formula funds. Next, I think everyone is aware of this one, but we have the FTA CARES Act funding, which was the $25 billion federal stimulus package that was passed in response to the pandemic. Our share of that is $220 million over multiple fiscal years. Next, we have Transportation Development Act, or TDA funding. This is a 0.25% of the regional sales tax assessed in the region, and it's administered by both SANDAG and the county. Then we have Transnet, which is a 0.5-cent sales tax in San Diego County, specifically for funding transportation projects. MTS receives both a formula share, and then we also receive direct reimbursement from SANDAG for Transnet-funded operations, such as our BRT service. Then we have our state transit assistance, which is a state sales tax on diesel fuel distributed based on population and agency revenue. And then lastly, we have a category for other. This includes our Medi-Cal revenue for trips to and from managed care providers, fast track revenue, which is toll road revenue from SANDAG. Then we have an agreement with UCSD to operate their shuttle service. And then we have some smaller pots of funding from the City of San Diego and North County Transit District for some of the services we operate. And then lastly, it also includes the taxi cab and San Diego and Arizona Eastern Railroad self-funded reserves. So looking at the actual numbers, our federal revenue was unfavorable by $121,000 or 0.2%. Our FTA CARES Act funding was unfavorable by $15.6 million or 46.6%. I don't think unfavorable is the right word to use here, though. It really means that we needed less FTA CARES Act funding to bridge the operating deficit, since that operating deficit was lower than we had initially projected. Then next, we have TDA. We were favorable $4.7 million or 8% to budget. So here we had projected a $6 million decrease due to the pandemic, and we actually ended up receiving the full FY20 pre-COVID TDA claim amount due to a couple factors. One, the sales tax receipts were higher than we had projected, and then also the TDA has a reserve balance that they use to keep those claims whole. Next, we have Transnet, where we were favorable by $628,000 or 1.6%. So here we had budgeted a $2 million reduction due to the pandemic, and we ended favorable here due to higher than projected sales tax receipts. STA, we ended the year $1.6 million favorable to budget, or 17.3%. This was just due to the allocations from the state being higher than what we had budgeted. We have received revised forecasts for FY21, and based on these new forecasts, it does look like most of the impact is coming in this fiscal year, FY21. And then lastly, we have other, where we finished the year $566,000 unfavorable, or 5.2%, and that was lower Medi-Cal revenue due to lower paratransit volumes, and then lower fast track revenue, as well as we did not use as much SDNAE or reserves for ballot measure in fiscal year FY20. So when we look at the operating activities and the non-operating or subsidy revenue combined, we had a favorable operating income of $13.5 million, and then we had unfavorable subsidy or non-operating activities of $9.3 million, resulting in total excess revenues over expenses of just under $4.2 million. So I did want to point out on this slide that if we were to back out the CARES Act funding, we do have a structural deficit of $13.7 million. And that's really just based on 4 months of COVID impact. So it's just something we need to be mindful of as we move forward. And then this brings us to our discussion on the contingency reserve balance. So just a reminder that the board policy for our contingency reserve balance has a target set at 12.5% of the operating expense budget. So for FY21, our target is $39.3 million. Based on the final FY20 year-end results, we ended with $4.1 million in excess revenues over expenses. So if we were to add all of that $4.1 million to the contingency reserve, that would put us at 13.3% of the operating budget, which is $2.6 million higher than our reserve target. So based on this, staff is recommending that we allocate $1.5 million to the contingency reserve to achieve our 12.5% target, and that we move that excess $2.6 million to the capital improvement program to reflect the board's decision to accelerate zero-emission bus purchases in FY22. And that brings us to the official staff recommendation that the Board of Directors approve the allocation of $4.1 million in FY20 excess net operating subsidy as follows. Allocate $1.5 million to the contingency reserve balance to remain at our 12.5% target, and transfer $2.6 million to the CIP to reflect the Board's decision to accelerate zero-emission bus purchases in FY22. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you for that presentation. Before we go to board member comments or questions, I'll ask the clerk if we have any requests for public comment on this item.
Janelle Sisting. Oh, not on this item. Sorry, sir. Sorry, Chair.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. No requests. Any board member comments? All right. Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the staff recommendations?
This is Member Solis. Move to approve staff recommendation.
And Sankey will back that up with a second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right. This has got a motion and a second. Can I just make one quick comment on the motion?
Of course, Vice Chair.
Thank you. That when we have this breakdown as well, we clarify how much then is left in our contingency reserve and what we, again, the presentation that we received, but knowing what the impact will be if we remove this $1.5 million contingency reserve monies, I think people need to know the impact of COVID-19 and how we are now going into our reserves. So I just want to make sure that staff really emphasizes that. But thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Any other questions, board member comments? All right. Hearing none, we have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any opposed? Hearing none, that motion carries. We're now going to move into our report items, and I think we're doing very, very well on time. We ought to be able to power through these and then get into to closed session. Our first presentation, item 45, SANDAG 2021 Regional Plan. We appreciate it. I believe Hassan is here along with some other folks, and so we will turn this over to the presentation at this point.
Hi, I believe Brian Lane is on from SANDAG.
Yes, and so is Colleen Clemenson.
Okay, great. Why don't you kick it off, Colleen?
I will. So good morning, MTS board members. Thank you so much for having us here today. Hassan will be joining us at 9:30. So we are just so pleased to be here and pleased with your interest in the reimagining of our region's transportation future. So Brian Lane and I are here to present the vision to you all and very, very interested in your input. I wanted to kick this off by saying how grateful we are to the MTS staff who have just been exceptional in their collaboration with us, multiple meetings, a half-day workshop before we presented all of this to our board of directors in August. And I think, you know, we've learned a lot from everything that you did with the Elevate 2020 project and really have brought all of that into this big picture vision. So with that, I'm looking forward to going through the vision presentation with you all as we talk about really reimagining the region's transportation future. So I'm hoping this is all going to just, technology is going to be my friend here. And here we go. Is this showing up for everyone?
Yes.
Yeah, Colleen, I got it.
Yes.
Okay. And do you see the whole slide or are you seeing my notes on the side?
We don't see your notes, but it is in presenter's mode. So we see two slides at the same time.
So unfortunate. So,
but it's still clear.
How about
Colleen,
now?
If you select display settings at the top of the PowerPoint and then to the right, display settings, right there, and then hit swap, that should fix it.
There we go. Thank you. Okay. Sweating bullets here. Thank you, everyone. Okay. So what we are solving for here are really three challenges with the regional plan. We are solving for congestion, addressing social equity, and meeting our state and federal mandates. And what this gets us is faster, fairer, and cleaner. That's what we're talking about. Congestion in the region. I think we all know that when the pandemic started, our freeways were largely free flow, but traffic is coming back and it's just about where it was before COVID. And this is throughout our region on all of our major freeway corridors. When we're talking about social equity, we're talking about our minority populations, low income, and seniors. And these three figures, the darker the areas, the higher the concentration of that particular population. And so these are the things that we all need to be thinking about. How are we serving the minority populations? How are we serving low income and our growing senior population? And these are things we know at MTS you're thinking about all the time too. And then the legislative mandate. So it's Senate Bill 375, the climate legislation that requires SANDAG to put together a plan that will show how we will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and doing that by reducing the vehicle miles traveled per person. We also need to meet federal Title VI requirements, compliance with civil rights and requirements for environmental justice considerations. And then going forward, the California Environmental Quality Act and Senate Bill 743, which requires all our transportation projects to be multimodal. No longer can we have projects that are only roadway improvements for single occupant vehicles. We need to be mitigating for that by having higher speed transit and bike and pedestrian multimodal approaches. This has been a data-driven approach, and Ray Major was going to be joining us today. He and his team recently produced a report about the economic impact of COVID on the San Diego community, and that turned out to be on the front page of the Union Tribune this morning. And so he's been called by multiple entities to do news interviews. And so he couldn't be here today, but Ray and his team have provided data that allowed us to really kind of start from scratch when it comes to planning the region's transportation network and starting with the very basics, where people live, and that's shown with the population density figure on the left, and where they work. And where they work are these employment centers. And this employment center work is original work that also came from the SANDAG data and analytics team, looking at the highest concentrations of employees. And what you see here is that it's not all in downtown or Sorrento Valley or Kearny Mesa. We have employment centers throughout the region. When you pull these two together, the where we live and where we work, we really see that it's in all the western third of the region or the western quarter, and we have the potential to be able to fully connect this people to where they live and work, and really doing this through a high-speed, state-of-the-art transit network. I'm going to show you a few additional slides about data, so we were able to take advantage of data from census to better understand where, when, what kind of trips people are making to and from work. We were able to consolidate a lot of that data, and the darker the lines show the greater number of trips that people are making, and the blue dots are the major employment centers. So you start to see all of these critical connections that need to be made. And the darker the lines, the more people that are making that trip are the best opportunities for public transit. Again, looking at other draws, critical connections, the trips from the border, trips to and from our tribal reservations, military bases, all of this comes into play as we're looking at trip making throughout the region. So using data, the strategy was to apply the five big moves. And the five big moves are five interrelated strategies. They all depend upon one another for the success of one another. You can't just say we're going to do complete corridors or we're going to do the next operating system. All of these work together. And it really starts with our mobility hubs. These are our highest density areas throughout the San Diego region where we have mixed use development and the opportunity to provide multiple types of transportation from these areas and to these areas. Flexible fleets really close that gap that as we all work in the transit world, how we make that first and last mile connection to transit. And so really thinking about flexible fleets, how they would operate. This is, you know, everything from bikes and carpools and how those operate on our local streets and roads, as well as on the highway system, and using flexible fleets to help close that gap, that first last mile. Complete corridors, as we think of all of our major freeway corridors, thinking of all of them as being multimodal. And probably the best example we have of that is work underway right now in the North Coast Corridor, where we're making improvements on the Low Sand Rail Corridor, improvements for HOV lanes on I-5, bicycle and pedestrian improvements in that area, and that an overall multimodal approach. And this really takes it to the next level. What's happening on the local streets and roads? How do we integrate high-speed transit? How do we manage that system through real-time information? All of that coming together to make our corridors completely multimodal. Transit Leap is really taking transit to the next level. High-speed transit that's 80, 90, 100 miles an hour, so that truly is competitive with driving. And this is what helps us get beyond serving just the transit dependent. And then finally, the technology, the next operating system, the glue that makes us all work and really maximizes our current and future investments. So just to look at a big picture overview of what we're talking about with the bold new transportation vision, we're talking about a system of managed lanes throughout our highways. So this is managing the system and making sure that we have HOV lanes, hot lanes, fully connected throughout our region. Improvements on our rural highways as well, because we need to make sure that we have access and the ability for flexible fleets to run, escape routes for fire and safety, the high-speed transit. And this also includes the light rail that MTS has been so successful with. adding in the mobility hubs, connections through flexible fleets, and the next operating system. So this just kind of gives you a visual of what we're talking about with the vision. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian Lane, who's going to dig into the details for all of you on Transit Leap. And Brian, I will advance your slides as you move along here.
All right. Good morning. I'm Brian Lane, Senior Transit Planner with Sandag. Sandag's been considered a leader in providing transportation options. And we've heard a lot from our residents that even though transit works for a lot of folks today, for many, driving on congested freeways during rush hour is the only viable option. We've also heard that transit can be slow, doesn't go where people need it to go, and doesn't operate when they want it to. What we will show you today will demonstrate that we will build a comprehensive transit system that will provide a better alternative for our residents. These services will be analyzed in much more detail through our comprehensive multimodal corridor plan process. Colleen, did we lose the presentation?
We're good. We're good.
Okay, I'm not seeing the PowerPoint.
Go ahead, Brian. It should be. Is everyone seeing it, or did we lose it?
It's gone.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. There it is. Oh.
Oh my God.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yep. Don't click anything, Colleen. All right. Before I show you the network, it's important to remember it's based on the analysis of data that Colleen showed you earlier. We developed this network through an iterative process that began with over 5,000 possible connections. Next slide. We used a computer program to refine these connections down to an initial network of 19 possible express and local commuter rail routes. We knew this was likely unaffordable, so we needed to find a way to further look at the data to find the routes with the biggest bang for the buck. Next slide. We then developed a propensity score. Essentially, we identified where the strongest connections existed, and then we did the same process for the stations. This allowed us to develop the proposed Transit Leap network. So here we go. Our envisioned Transit Leap network includes a comprehensive system of commuter rail, light rail, and next-gen rapid services. You'll see, you'll notice many similarities with this and the projects in Elevate SD. We worked with MTS staff to ensure our ideas were in alignment and could feed off of each other. This network will provide fast and frequent service, 10 minutes or better, will be separated from congestion, and in many cases will offer travel times that are comparable to driving. With this proposed network, we think that many residents will want to choose transit over the car. All right, so go ahead and click through Colleen. There we go. So commuter rail, the dark purple lines, commuter rail routes are designed to be completely separated from cars by operating in tunnels or on bridges. Trains hopefully can go much faster, up to 125 miles an hour, and travel longer distances in shorter amounts of time. Our goal with these services is to provide trip times that are comparable with driving. We're proposing to add a route from the Central Mobility Hub to the border through downtown, National City, and Chula Vista. The next route is known as the purple route line, and would come from the border and then serve Southeast San Diego, North Park and University Heights, then head north through Mission Valley to Kearny Mesa, and then on to UTC, ending at Sereno Mesa. We look forward to refining this project with the South Beta Sereno comprehensive multimodal corridor plan that we're working on. The third commuter rail route would be an east-west line coming from El Cajon, serving La Mesa, SDSU, City Heights, then splitting at University Heights to either go downtown or to the Central Mobility Hub. The fourth rail route is the coaster and would include tunnels in Del Mar and near UTC, as well as adding stations in Camp Pendleton at Gas Lamp and at Sereno Mesa and the new Balboa trolley station. Our second service type is one we know well, the light rail, the trolley and the sprinter services, and it could be upgraded to provide separation at major intersections to reduce conflicts with cars, increasing the frequency and the number of trains per hour to provide better accessibility, and increase operating hours, which will enable people to use these services early in the morning and very late in the evening. In our interviews, we heard that people need to be able to use these services up to 20, 22 hours a day. Shown in dark pink, we include the blue line with the addition of Midcoast to UC San Diego and UTC. We got the orange line. Let's see if it comes in. There we go. The green line. And then a new tram service has also been added to provide for easier connections in our most urban areas. Circling Balboa Park, it would likely use 30th Street on the east side, 5th Street on the west, Market and C Streets in the south, and then El Cajon Boulevard and University Avenue in the north. adding in enhancements to the Sprinter in the North County, and we have a lot of new and improved rail services across the county. And our third big service is the Next Gen Rapid. San Diego got a taste of our first generation of rapid routes in recent years, but we're going to apply everything we've learned and make them even better. More priority lanes, better signal priority, better technology, longer spans of service, and less times between trips will allow users to get where they want to go faster. There are roughly 30 net new next-gen rapid routes proposed, and I'll highlight a few that we think will generate the highest ridership. Route 10 would travel from Ocean Beach to La Mesa via Mid-City, Hillcrest, and the Central Mobility Hub. Rapid 28 would go from Point Loma to Kearny Mesa via the Central Mobility Hub and Linda Vista. Rapid 292 would travel from Pacific Beach to Otay Mesa through Kearny Mesa, along the 52 to Santee, to El Cajon, Rancho San Diego, and then south to Otay Mesa along the 125. It would likely be split into two routes to improve efficiency. The Rapid 625 would serve SDSU, Southeast San Diego, National City, and end at Palomar Trolley Station in Chula Vista. Rapid 635 would travel along Main Street in Chula Vista, connecting Eastlake and Otay Ranch to the Palomar Transit Station. The Rapid 638 would be the arterial version of the soon-to-be-built Rapid 950, traveling from the Iris Trolley Station to Otay Mesa border crossing via Otay Mesa Road and Airway Drive. A couple more dozen rapid routes will be added across the region to complete the network. You'll notice again that many of these routes were in Elevate SD and would be refined through the CMCP process. Not shown on this map are local buses and flexible fleets. Local bus services are the workhorses of the transit system and support shorter trips that are more ingrained in the community. We will assess local bus routes to see if they still make sense. In areas where more on-demand, door-to-door services are appropriate, we would evaluate using flexible fleets. You'll hear more about those in a little bit. Most of the local bus routes would get frequency and span of service upgrades in the early phases of the regional plan. The network also includes special projects such as a future connection to the airport via a people mover from the Central Mobility Hub. The dotted teal line shows potential California high-speed rail services that connect to areas outside the region, with a possible new east-west line across the Palomar Airport road area for regional connections to high-speed rail. Okay, so mobility hubs. I'll talk a little bit about those. Mobility hubs work best in places with a high concentration of people, destinations, and travel choices. A mobility hub isn't limited to siting or sitting a handful of services at a single transit station. We're thinking much bigger about how a lot of travel options, safe streets, and supporting technology can be spread across communities to make getting around easier. A whole community comprises a mobility hub. Essentially, mobility hubs do two things: help people seamlessly connect to and from Transit Leap, and make it easier than ever to make short trips without relying on a personal car, all while creating spaces where people feel both comfortable and respected as they travel from one part of the region to another. It's vital to have a connected network of mobility hubs so people can reach more places. The proposed network could be comprised of our region's urban core plus 30 more mobility hubs, all co-located with Transit Leap to serve many employment and recreational destinations. There we go. The urban core could span downtown and surrounding higher density residential and commercial areas, everything from Mid-City to Barrio Logan to Midway. Four gateway hubs could be key entry points into the Five Big Moves network. Let's see, one more click, there we go. Next, nine major employment centers that offer mixed use development opportunities. And then eight coastal hubs that are popular seaside destinations for residents and visitors alike. And then nine suburban, mostly residential neighborhoods situated near Transit Leap routes. All of these mobility hubs would offer the highest concentration of Transit Leap and flexible fleet services, everything from next-gen rapid to e-bikes. By 2050, we could anticipate these hubs covering approximately half of the region's residents and more than two-thirds of the region's jobs, making them great opportunities to boost the live, work, play lifestyle. And with nearly half of our region's trips being 3 miles or less, mobility hubs could offer a unique opportunity to really transform how we move around our communities using pedal bikes, electric bikes, mopeds, and more. So now flexible fleets. The diverse suite of services that are concentrated in mobility hubs just are at the center of the flexible fleet strategy, which envisions providing shared, electric, on-demand services that provide new and affordable options for moving around the region. Flexible fleets provide reliable connections to transit within mobility hubs, and because flexible fleets are enabled by technology, they can easily adapt to new environments and changing conditions. It's this flexibility and convenience that makes it easy to imagine how you might travel using these services without relying on a car. Our research helped us to identify 5 flexible fleet service types. Micromobility includes low occupancy, low speed devices like bikes and scooters that are generally best suited for short trips. Ride hail services like Uber and Lyft let you request a ride from a driver in real time. Or if you prefer to drive yourself, you can book a car share vehicle as a short term rental. Rideshare services like carpool, vanpool, and pooled ride hail, like Uberpool and Lyft Share, provides trips to people headed in the same direction. Microtransit includes on-demand shuttle services that provide shared trips from door to door. In recent years, and particularly in the last few months, we've seen a huge shift to online retail and deliveries. New approaches like electric bikes, delivery bots, and drones help make deliveries to homes and smart lockers while reducing freight congestion on local roads. And then next, because of the different services and vehicles that are available, flex fleets can serve all types of communities. In our mobility hub network, you'd likely find a wide variety of flexible fleets operating that provide reliable connections to transit and provide an alternative for shorter trips. But in other parts of the region, flexible fleets play an equally important role by providing more travel options. Services like rideshare and microtransit are ideal for suburban and rural areas. In fact, vanpools are a great example of a service that has long provided a reliable transportation option in less urban areas. Drones could make deliveries in our rural communities, and microtransit could provide an alternative in rural villages and tribal areas by transitioning underutilized local buses to smaller on-demand fleets. Many flexible fleets are operated by the private sector, so collaborative partnerships are critical to ensuring these services thrive. We also need key stakeholders like cities, transit agencies, and community-based organizations at the table. This enables flexible fleet services cater to community needs, including providing affordable options for low-income families and youth, offer accessible vehicles for people with disabilities and seniors, and also creating choices for people without smartphones or credit cards to use these services. All right, at this point, I'll turn it back over to Colleen.
Thank you, Brian. So just to lay out the timeline for where we are in the process, right now we are working very closely with your staff as well as Caltrans and NCTD to get all this data put into our transportation model so that we can evaluate the greenhouse gas reductions. We anticipate that by the end of the calendar year, we will have the results of that work. We're also beginning the technical analysis required for the environmental review. One of the things that we had shared with NCTD when we met with them is that we also have a number of corridor plans that are underway. One in particular is the San Diego Losan Regional Rail Corridor study that's getting underway. We also have multiple other corridor plans, including a look at the Purple Line, Blue Line, I-5 South, and 805 South. And so that is a project area that we're referring to as the South Bay to Sorrento. And so we will be presenting that to our transportation committee this Friday. There's also a corridor study underway to look at the Central Mobility Hub and connections to Coronado and connections to the airport. We have a C to Santee, which is really looking at that kind of 52 corridor. So all of those are currently underway. We anticipate, you know, we're working on that simultaneously as we look to release our draft plan in spring next year, and we'll be asking the board of directors to adopt a plan roughly a year from now. So just to conclude, we do have a very short video, and I think that's going to be run from the MTS team, if I'm not mistaken. And then Hassan will be joining us, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
We're attempting to get the video started right now.
Okay, good deal. Do I need to stop sharing my screen? I think that's what I... Turn it back. And there's Hassan, too, if you want to say a few words while we're getting the video set up, Hassan.
Hassan, I think you're muted.
Transportation isn't just about getting us from point A to point B. It's about connecting us to each other, to our environment, to our communities, connecting us to everything and everyone we love. But congestion and the absence of alternatives are breaking these connections, creating a divide between where we are and where we want to be. We are losing time. We now have the opportunity to think differently about how we connect, a chance to truly innovate. Across our region, Sandag's bold transportation vision can accommodate the diverse demands of the entire county, as well as the unique needs of individual communities. At the border, people can be welcomed by a variety of choices to quickly get them where they want to go. Roadways can be reimagined to balance space between cars and other ways of travel, and shift based on demand. Our neighbors can enjoy new choices for getting to school, to the store, and back home. Businesses can move goods more efficiently, while employees can enjoy smart alternatives to the daily commute. From the edges to its center, our region can be more connected. Through thoughtful planning and careful execution, we can deliver a world-class transportation system that protects our environment and strengthens our communities. The regional plan may be counted in dollars or miles, but its success will be measured in time. Our biggest plans will be repaid in the smallest moments.
Hassan, I believe that you are not connected to audio. And you're self-muted.
There we go.
Okay.
There we go. You're good now. You can talk.
Yes. So thank you very much, Chair, board members. Thank you for allowing us to be with you for a few minutes. As you've seen in the presentation, seen over the last couple of months, we're trying to reimagine the future of transportation system in San Diego. And I believe the team here have delivered the system that's multimodal, that give people choices, and that give us a state-of-the-art system that anticipate technology, but yet build the infrastructure of the future. I think you heard about in the media and elsewhere that, oh my God, this plan is very expensive. So And yes, it's a lot of money, $177 billion over three decades. But reminding you that the existing plan is also $130 billion. So for an additional $47 billion over 30 years, you really get much more than the system offered today. So our hope is we move this vision and make it a plan. As Colleen mentioned, we will be putting a draft plan sometimes in April of next year. We believe that San Diegan is, at the end of the day, is going to be who decide whether this plan is a yay or nay, because they're the one who's going to pay for it. And we're very hopeful and very optimistic that once San Diegans understand, tangibly understand what we're trying to do, I think they will support such a plan. So thank you, Chairman. Thank you, board members. And Colleen and I will be very happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Hassan and Colleen and everyone at SANDIAC. There's no action force to take this informational item only, but we do want to give board members the opportunity to ask any questions or make any comments. I know Councilmember Sankey has a question, I believe. Mr. Sankey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Hassan, Colleen, first of all, as a visual professional, I want to share that that video is absolutely amazing videos and very compelling and tells the real story about what you're trying to do here. It is a big ask. Colleen, from your presentation, I continue to kind of wonder why the jobs at the Navy bases in Coronado aren't included as real jobs. They're called activity centers. You and I have had this discussion before, and while I know you guys have reasoning that it doesn't, that they aren't, I'm gonna continue to wonder about that. You certainly found a way to count them related to RENA, and so let's see if we can find them, get them included in the transit planning. I know that the Navy base actually has instituted a intra-base shuttle now, and the base commander was talking to me about lack of riders for the thing. So if we can get better rapid service to the mobility hub that's at the base gate at North Island, or perhaps find a way to better serve the folks at the new Navy SEAL base with bus service, because it's going to be a long time before any kind of rail gets considered. I know Hassan's talking about linking us to the mobility hub by the airport, but that's a long, long way off. Brian, in your presentation, I was absolutely thrilled to see the ferry boat still part of the options. The activation in Chula Vista of the huge development that they've got going on in their waterfront to connect folks there over water to the downtown, to use some military bases to have stops there. We do at MTS have some modeling data that's looked at that, and I hope that continues to stay in the discussion. My question actually is, I sort of saw something missing. I didn't see trolley to the airport, and that's something that's been a particularly important part of MTS's planning going forward. And I know when we were doing Elevate, it was one of the most highly rated projects to do. So my question basically to you, Colleen, and maybe Hassan, to talk about the relationship between trolley to the airport and the people mover as far as planning goes right now. And then my final comment is, I liked especially the different planning hubs where smaller regions, coastal hubs get a hub, more regional places get a hub, and of course the four major hubs that you guys have designed. And I wonder if as those get instituted, we could start with some of the smaller ones, maybe lower hanging fruit, less acquisition for property, and might prove their mettle as the project goes forward. So again, thinking in terms of getting things done sooner rather than having the last nail pounded in 30 years from now and finally finishing. So again, my question involves the relationship between trolley to the airport and the people mover.
Thank you, Councilmember. Thank you. This is an important question. So, of course, the trolley to the airport is a big part of the mobility hub, the central mobility hub. So if you recall, when we did the study, the initial study of alternatives to get to the airport, there were four alternatives. One is an underground people mover from the hub to the airport. The two next ones are a surface people mover about 3.5 miles to the airport, and a fourth is a direct trolley connection to the airport. These are still the alternatives, and however the analysis leads us moving forward, but the trolley to the airport is still a big part of the four alternatives.
Thanks, Hassan. I appreciate that.
Of course. As to the, we have about 31 mobility hubs around the region, and you're right, they're different in sizes, the biggest being the central mobility hubs in the San Cedro, the second biggest. There is definitely some mobility hubs is going to take a shorter time and less money to do than others. We're very open to in terms of phasing. We haven't gotten to that. Once it becomes a plan, then we will look at what goes first. And finally, I just, you know, we don't have to wait 30 years to get a central mobility hub done. I just want to share with the board that last week I was in Washington, D.C. We met with the Navy and the Pentagon, and we met with the Office of Management. And I think there's a commitment to move this project if it's the project that we decide to do, the mobility hub at the Navwar. We are in the environmental phase. And I'm happy to tell you that the governor last week signed 2731, which does the CEQA streamlining for. So we don't have to wait 30 years if the region is committed. But let me also make it clear that none of these proposals in the vision have money, local money. So short of getting a new revenue source, none of this will happen. And then we have to be frank about this, whether it's going to happen in the next year or 20 years from now. I believe that's what I said earlier. San Diegans will have a big decision to make. Our leaders, like yourselves, are going to have big things to make. I happened to be last week with Supervisor Fletcher, your chair, at the Midcoast, at one of the most beautiful stations, the hospital. And you know, once you're there, you get an appreciation that infrastructure projects that mean something is going to take a long time. The Midcoast is going to open next year and going to be turned to MTS to operate, and it's going to be an amazing system that have a one-seat ride from the border to the university. It's going to take shorter time commuting on the trolley than if you drive in the peak on the 5 freeway. That's the kind of system we're designing. But I think you all know that the Midcoast took 13 years to get to this point. And by the time we open it, it's 14 years. So if we want to do something that has any value, any significance to the future, I think it's going to take time. So when you mention 30 years, most major infrastructure projects take time to build.
Thanks, Hassan, very much. Your team is well on their way to getting us a plan for next year that hopefully the board will look kindly upon. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Councilmember Sankey. Thank you, Hassan. Any other board member comments or questions? All right, Vice Chair Alejandro Sotelo Solis. Mayor, are you there?
Thank you so much. Thank you, staff, for unmuting me. I just want to say thank you again to our MTS and Sandag staff for really looking at this opportunity jointly, to know that we are all spokes in this wheel of opportunity and really thinking outside of the box. I look forward to the ongoing dialogue. My questions are with regards to community engagement, but I know we have heard how many folks have been engaged in this, and if there's just a quick, you know, two sentences on how many voices have been heard, including the elected officials from the board of directors of SANDAG, as well as members here who have pushed out, you know, just that data collection. But again, I think it's a great opportunity, and no one is in a silo. We all are in this together. And so if staff at SANDAG could just answer that, one of my big, that I will be looking at is the purple line, as well as the connection to the airport. So Hassan, I don't know if you heard the question, is how many people have been interviewed? Yes. Okay. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And I'll wait to hear the answer with bated breath from Mr. Ikrada.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mayor Solis. Absolutely. Look, we have been in the community meeting with stakeholders over the past few months, and I can tell you that our goal is to reach the public in a significant way and in different ways than in the past. But I also want to mention, you know, unfortunately, because of COVID-19, MTS did not move forward with the measure. And I think they did an amazing work reaching out to the communities. And I want to make it clear on the record that whether it's MTS or SANDAG, we see the same thing. And this vision captured exactly the ideas that MTS was trying to do. So we have one vision, one region, and I believe it will be an amazing thing for us to join forces and make sure that this vision moves forward. But to your point, Alejandra Solis, is community outreach is not only required by law for us to do, but it is actually a desired outcome when this is done. And, you know, we don't have to go to places where there is only support, but we need to have a discussion, a public policy debate. And you yourself have been an amazing partner in this and connecting us with stakeholders that need to hear about this. But we are ready and able to go out there to the community and do more outreach than ever done before, like MTS did an excellent job on the measure. I also, your chair knows this, that any future regional transportation plan at SANDAG has to capture all the work that MTS did so far. I think there's more discussion to be done on how we do this, what's short-term and what's long-term, and how we also make sure there is funding for existing systems, for existing riders, given the disparity and the equity issues that we're facing.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Hassan. And thank you for kind of segueing into the brief comments I wanted to make, which is the appreciation of a long-term vision and where we need to go, big ideas, bold ideas, but also the recognition that the bridge to that future, which will take some time, is that the day-to-day work that MTS does and the expanded opportunities we saw throughout the Elevate process where you can make an investment and begin to get immediate returns on the ability to move people and get there. And so I think you can't really do one without the other. You can't address the immediate needs of folks for more transit options without addressing the bigger systemic change that will truly make it work. And you're certainly not going to sell voters on investing in something decades away without showing them the immediate. And so I think the alignment of the two, taking the ideas and concepts and proposals that were developed and Elevate and figure how we marry those with the longer term things is certainly in the best interest of our region. So we appreciate your continued commitment to that and work around that. And we are ready to be partners and to work together to make sure we can advance the whole region forward. So good. Any other board member comments? All right. With that, Hassan, Colleen, Bill, we thank you all for your time. We thank you all for the work you're doing, and we certainly look forward to working with all of you as we move forward in the future. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you to the board members. And I just want to Mayor Solis's just final comment. The purple line and the blue line are the jewel of our system here. And we are together with MTS seeing exactly on how that goes. So look forward to working with you further. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hassan.
All right. Let's power through these others. I think we can get through 46 and 47. We may move 48. We'll see how we're doing on time, but let's jump right into agenda item 46, our fiscal year performance monitoring report. Important walkthrough on how we're doing as an agency.
So I'll just let you know the way we've structured this report. I'm sorry, this is Sharon Cooney. The way we've structured this report is Dennis is going to lead with our performance metrics for the year, and then we're going to have reports from both of our chief operating officers from bus and rail, and they're going to highlight some of the things that we accomplished in FY 2020. With that, I'll turn it over to Dennis.
Good morning. Dennis Desmond, Director of Planning for MTS. Let me get to our first slide here. Every fall, we bring to you a report on the previous fiscal year's performance, and our board policy 42 has 20 metrics that we evaluate all of our services each year. And I like in this presentation to go through a few highlights, but all of these metrics and the results of these are in the attachment. The attached performance monitoring report. So to go through a few highlights, looking first at ridership, which is always of very high interest. The ridership, because of COVID, was down overall this year, approximately 17% over last year, with an annual total of 71 million passengers, so down about 14 million from FY19. The very unfortunate part of the situation is that we were actually on track to have our best year since FY15. So on the right side of this slide, I put our projections for the year based on July through February of the fiscal year, the first 8 months. And based on that, if those trends had continued without COVID, we would have had over 88 million passengers this year. So we were actually doing very, very well, 3% bump, over 3% bump over the previous year, disrupted by COVID. We had a lot of success with a lot of the services that we added with the TOP in 2018. We reallocated resources, increased services on our core network routes, and we were seeing very, very good returns on those. The losses that we saw starting in the middle of March with COVID-19 mirror losses of transit agencies around the world. We just saw a report from Toronto and the Toronto Transit Commission. Their ridership trend looks exactly like ours. We actually did better than a lot of agencies. Some agencies lost over 90% of their ridership. The lowest that we got was about 65,000 passengers a day. That was on April 10th. It was 77% lower than our fall average. We've since stabilized back up at around 120,000 a day, so still far below our 275, but better, fortunately, than we were doing back in April and better than a lot of agencies have fared. We did make some temporary service reductions between April and June, and that was really for two reasons. One was because of the severe drop in ridership, and the other was to accommodate some staffing shortages that we had due to COVID. But we restored most of that service in June 2020, and we're at about 95% of our normal capacity. And we're doing that now, even with the lower ridership, because we're trying to maintain the service for essential workers trying to get to work. And dependent riders that don't have other choices, as well as keeping enough capacity out there that people can distance on the bus. We typically have a bump up in ridership on the beach routes. We didn't have that this year. Beaches were closed and people were staying away. in a lot of cases. And then typically in September, we get a bump up, especially with UCSD. We see about 15 to 20,000 extra riders. We haven't seen that this year. We're getting a little bit of an increase, but not what we typically see. One thing to point out, and this really echoes what Gordon said with the budget presentation, which is that we did see losses in the fourth quarter of FY20, but that those were really masked by the increases we had in quarters one through three. So it'll be interesting to see what that means for FY21, and that's all going to depend on the recovery and how fast things come back. So our primary efficiency metrics is the number of riders per revenue hour of service that we put on the street. And so that varies, of course, by the type of route. And this really mirrors the ridership because we're maintaining a lot of the service with fewer riders. You see decreases in this category. Overall, system-wide, about 13% lower than previous year. If there is a very small silver lining to this very, very large cloud, it's that the reduction in traffic out on the streets has actually meant that we have met our goal on-time performance in every single category for the first time that I can remember with the June 2020 service change. That's not reflected here yet because there's only a couple weeks of that service change, so this goes through the January shakeup. But by June, we had actually met the goal in every single category because there's so much less traffic on the streets right now. We have a few other metrics. I'll just quickly point out the miles between failures. This is how far our vehicles go between road calls or when maintenance needs to tend to them. And this varied a little bit on the directly operated bus side because we had some changes in the definition to match the federal reporting requirements. Our complaints per 100,000 passengers, this is an important metric of our customer satisfaction. And we had increases in most categories. Interestingly, a lot of this actually is related to COVID. In spite of the fact we had fewer riders, the COVID-related changes actually have increased complaints. Some of those due to rear door boarding, which we did to protect our operators before the plastic shields. But some passengers didn't like that and were vocal about that. And then complaints regarding mask wearing and other things. So we saw that actually go up towards the end of the year. And then our preventable accidents per 100,000 miles, this remained fairly stable from year to year. So our fare box recovery, this again was hurt by the reduction in ridership. So we are still above the TDA requirement for FY20. It may drop below in FY21. However, there are proposed changes to the TDA, and this is the Transportation Development Act, state source for a lot of our operating funding. There are proposed changes to those requirements because really when those requirements were made in 1978, the world is a lot different now, and there's recognition that transit has a lot of other goals, such as reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and reduction of congestion, things like that. And so that's going to be reflected probably in revisions to the TDA requirement. And lastly, I just want to point out the actual performance monitoring report, which is an attachment to the agenda item. The route statistic sheet looks a lot different than it has in the past years. We've added a lot of categories, and one thing I'll point out is that we've added a jurisdiction column. So if you're not familiar with every single route in the system and where it goes, it shows you which city and council district in the city of San Diego each route goes through, so you can see the routes in your specific jurisdiction that your constituents are using. And then the Title VI monitoring we add at the end. This is something that we do on an annual basis to comply with FTA requirements on Title VI. And lastly, there is a map attached of our jurisdiction in the back that we attach each year. So with that, I will turn it over to Mike Weigant, Chief Operating Officer for Transit Services, who will give an annual update on the bus services.
Thanks, Dennis. Chair Fletcher, members of the board. I'll go over some of our initiatives and our goals and some of our projects for the year. We put those together obviously way before the year starts, not knowing that COVID would hit. So probably the first area I kind of wanted to touch on is the impacts associated with COVID. You know, we really focused in on our goals and our major objectives for the year, but they all changed towards the end of the year. Making our first and top priority, obviously, the safety to the employees and the passengers. And it was a pretty significant undertaking in a short amount of time, as I know you guys were all aware. You know, we really put those initiatives focuses on the employees and the passengers, but also the operations in general and maintaining, you know, a safe environment in our operations divisions, but also our facilities. We worked with a lot of the external agencies, the county, NCTD, to make sure that we had one joint, combined, similar message. And then we worked very diligently in trying to communicate that to all of our partners and our customers and our employees. You know, some of the bigger things that were the initiatives, and there were a lot of them, we could be here all day going through them, but, you know, PPE for our employees, face coverings, masks, those are things we had to procure and get out and have complete inventories for them, not only initially, but through today and for the unforeseen future. Hand sanitizers, go kits. Those are disinfectant packs. We have a lot of operators and staff who are out in the field, and then they have bus swaps or vehicle swaps. And so it gives them the ability to actually sanitize and clean the vehicle while it's out in the field. We did have a few employees in the ops division on the bus side that could work remotely, but not many because we're so frontline heavy. And some of that was more of a rotation basis, but where we had people who weren't part of their job function necessarily need to be frontline or out in the field, we did have some rotations of staff, and we still have some of those today. We do things like temperature checks for all employees across the organization, not only just bus drivers, but everyone has to go through a temperature check on their way into work every day. But all of our transit store and our frontline facilities did remain open. We did have some amendments of hours initially, but we wanted to make sure that all those functionality for our public was still available, so none of that was lost. Dennis had mentioned before, and you may have heard before, we went through a quick process to install what we call germ barriers or a plexiglass shield, similar to what you would see at your local grocery store on every vehicle. That was a pretty significant undertaking, trying to engineer and find the materials while everyone in the world was looking for plexiglass was not easy. But we did it in a pretty short amount of time. We made some adjustments early on, as Dennis had mentioned, as far as a reduction in service and rear door boarding and suspending fare temporarily. But until we could get some of these in place to ensure the safety of our passengers and customers, our passengers and our operators, we followed through with those. But some of those adjustments were, of course, the germ barrier installation across the fleet. We also adjusted what we call the standee line. So if you're not familiar, inside the bus, as soon as you pass the fare box area, there's a line on the floor, and that's an indication for passengers to stay aft of that for their safety. We moved that back about 4 to 6 feet on all buses to give the operator a little more room to ensure their safety, but also for the passengers, that kind of established a gap while they were trying to manage fare collection. We did a lot of automated announcements at our facilities and on our vehicles about the public safety recommendations or requirements associated with masks and social distance and hand sanitizing. We adjusted some of our routes, not only with the original service reduction in April, and then we went back to almost full service in June, but we reallocated some of our articulated buses, even though maybe the loads didn't dictate it, to allow for additional social distance on the vehicles. Unfortunately, when COVID struck, a lot of restaurants and businesses that we had agreements to use their restrooms were closed, and so no longer available, so we actually procured and installed agreements with a lot of portable restrooms throughout the service area. And then the vehicles. We already had a pretty robust disinfectant process with basically bleach solutions to sanitize the vehicle that was happening every day. We increased that to a midday process also, and we also, and I think most of you have probably seen some media on it, implementing a fogging process where we spray a disinfectant is atomized into the air circulation system and the vehicle as it in its totality to sanitize the vehicle and all of its touch points. But we can still continue to do the bleach solution wipe down in addition to it. And then the vehicles, we have a significant amount of vehicles based on peak needs will go out in the morning. They'll come back to the yards, and then they'll go out in the afternoon. Historically, they would not get any additional servicing, but since COVID, we implemented what we call the midday cleaning. So every vehicle, regardless of if it's in for the day, it's going to get a midday. We applied a lot of this to the facilities. Obviously, the signage. We did have a few, like admin locations that we closed temporarily. We discontinued vendor visits, all for the safety of the employees and the operators, kind of minimized interactions with people if it wasn't essential, as we determined it. And we did a lot of germ barrier or reallocating of the office space, installing barriers for everyone's protection. I'll have some pictures a little later that'll show you that. And did increased disinfectant even in our operating facilities midday, or in some places added two or three additional cleanings per day. And then really a lot of training and education to everyone about the use of the PPE and hand sanitizing and wiping, and all the information was put out there, not only for their safety to make sure that, but everybody was educated. So here on the left is a picture of the plexiglass shields. Just so you know, they, with the exception of the paratransit fleet, which now also has them, this is more of a temporary solution. You, through the consent calendar today, actually approved what we call the full barrier project, which we were actually working on before COVID, but that's a little more of a long-term, structurally more robust shield. These plexiglass are working really well. They're clearly providing the protection that we need, but they are a temporary solution. You'll see some of the signage there in the middle. That's one of the examples of what we see as you enter a bus or in our facilities. And then on the right, that's our transit store at the Mills Building, where we've modified the office space a little bit, installed barriers for everyone's protection. Out in the actual public side of it, too, we put up some barriers and some signage to indicate where to stand to allow social distance, and then, of course, the mask requirements. So, back to our original goals and objectives and priorities for the year. We had a pretty good year. Dennis went over some of it, but I'll try to touch on some of it outside of the COVID responsibilities that we had at the end of the year. With the new FTA requirements under SMS, system safety, the bus side now, like the rail, has to have a full agency safety plan. The plan focuses in on a lot of additional reporting, but probably the biggest change to it that the bus side would see is like risk identification and management. You're now required to document your risks and have a process for everyone to report it all the way up to the CEO level. So we implemented that plan ahead of the regulation requirement, and we're out. It's not something you just put on the shelf. We're actually having regular meetings and doing that risk assessment and working on plans to mitigate or completely eliminate those risks. Our CHP inspections, we've had some media stuff about that recently. We had another perfect year. I think it's our eighth straight year where we have failed. We have not had any out-of-service vehicles as part of that inspection. All five divisions get a CHP inspection, and in some of those divisions, they actually get multiple ones. They not only look at the vehicles, they look at the maintenance records, they look at driver and operator training records, they look at drug and alcohol training programs, and what we call the pull notice, which is our oversight of the DMV and how they put points or have restrictions on people's licenses. So we had zero deficiencies in all five of those audits. And all of our rest of our regulatory inspections, things like OSHA, stormwater, air pollution control district, we all had perfect inspections across the system for the year. A couple of proactive projects I'll just go over real quick for safety. Obviously getting through COVID was the biggest challenge at the end of the year, but safety for everyone is always our top priority. We went through this year and completed a project that we've been looking at for a few years. We did a pilot on it, but we did a full implementation of installing cameras on all of our non-revenue vehicles. Our contractors have them too, but now on the in-house side, every vehicle has two-camera system, so it sees out the back, and then, of course, it looks out the front. It sees the driver. It also does live GPS tracking and speed tracking, so we get alerts and notifications if they're not following our requirements as far as operating a vehicle. But it's really there, not so much as a deterrent, but in the event we do have an incident or a report, whether from an operator or the public, to really investigate, like we have on our revenue vehicles, investigate the incident, get a real true story of exactly what happened. So that's been a good project. All the vehicles are outfitted, and that, that project's been completed. A couple of projects are in a beta testing or a pilot. We call it the A-pillar project. So it's a big industry concern. The design of a transit bus creates a bit of an A-pillar blind spot. You can kind of see it in this picture on the right. A combination of the mirror, and the mirror can actually be higher or lower depending on the vehicle design, but a combination of the mirror and the actual structural component or the A-pillar of the bus creates a blind spot. There have been, unfortunately, some incidents throughout the country where they're usually pedestrian strikes or bicycles are hit when operators don't see them. And so we're testing two different systems. One's more of a beta right now. In other words, we're working with the OEM to kind of refine that product to do alerts. As you can see in this picture, where actually we'll show that there's an indicator that there's somebody standing behind that A-pillar, the operator just can't see them. So some of it's visual, some of it's audible, and of course it would report back to us. Another product that we're testing is more off the shelf, and we're testing that for functionality in our system. So I assume by next year, we'll be looking at trying to implement one of those as a deployment on our fleet. Another pilot that we're looking at to improve our safety proactively is what we call the rearview mirror cameras. Some of the buses now are coming with backup cameras like you'd see on your regular car. In most cases, it's required by law. But what we want to implement into that is the rearview mirror on the bus to also, when you open, especially on an articulated bus, when you open what we call the rear door or the midsection door, that's a long ways for an operator to try to identify by just looking at a typical convection mirror to see what's actually happening. And so now on the pilot that we're using, it actually brings up the image from the existing camera system so that the operator can see more clearly if there is any intrusions or, you know, potential passengers or any concerns with opening or closing the door. So that's a pilot I'm hoping will be pretty productive, and we can hopefully move to implementing that on existing fleet and making it a standard on new vehicles. Support services, which is our customer service department, also inclusive of like trip planning and Compass, you know, so they really help us out with a lot of data. They give us that, you know, customer experience approach and what things that we can focus in on. We tasked that team to get really invested in a few different things. One of their big initiatives this year was what we call our safety first, or our services safety focus group. And we go through, and with that help of data that we get from the customers and from the vehicles, we identify kind of our areas that we really need to work on. And what one of them this year was pass-ups. It's been a big initiative for us. Pass-ups are a customer is either at a bus stop or in close proximity to the bus stop, and the operator didn't see them and didn't stop, and thus they missed the bus. And so we went out and looked at our hot areas. We looked at our driver training. We looked at the signage. We looked at the information. We looked at things like trees and route structures, and successfully implemented a few things with a 15% reduction over the year. So I think that's a good news story. That department also works hand in hand with our finance department. We had a fare change earlier in the year. That there's a lot of work with that, not only the communication with our internal and external customers, but a lot of system improvements to make sure that it's a good customer experience as it possibly could be. And also our next gen system, which will go into service next year, they play a key role in trying the testing process of that, or the implementations of the policies and the procedures associated with our next gen. On the fleet side, with the exception of Zeb's, it was a fairly light year with vehicle design and replacements. We only had the 6 40-foot CNG buses that we built during the last fiscal year, but we worked diligently on improving ourselves, and not only on the cost side, but also the reliability side. One of the big issues we struggled with the CNG engines is what we call the aluminum piston problem, and we've been working with the OEMs to beta a steel piston conversion with the hope of improving reliability, but also specifically reducing overall cost, lengthening the overhaul cost of the engines. And we've had some good success with that. But overall, we resulted in a reduction in our mean distance between failures. On the access side, our paratransit side, we reduced our preventable accidents. A lot of that was because of the camera system. We installed backup cameras on all of our access vehicles, or about 50%. The project eventually will do 100% implementation. And we also had, as you know, a new access minibus operating contract. That's a 10-year contract, six as part of the base and a couple option years. And we did get some success with amending a grant to improve our scheduling system to hope that our access customers will have a cashless fare option with the next gen next year. South Bay Rapid had some improvements, and we finished the last of the kind of the bus only lanes. That project improves the travel times between Otay Mesa and downtown. We have several bus only lane portions of it, and we finished the final segment of it this last year with the intent of not only improving the on-time performance, as Dennis had mentioned, but also reducing the total travel distance or time for the travel. Some facility aspects, we're always working on state of good repair for shelters and amenities. Here's a couple of examples of the improvements that we made over the last year. And then the ZEB pilot, I think you're all pretty familiar with at the last board meeting. You know, we talked pretty heavily about it, but just as a reminder, we put six of the battery electric buses into revenue service. Those are the ones in the far on the bottom left there. We've purchased and got the agreement for the two additional Gillig electric buses that will start to be delivered next month. We've installed the six additional chargers to not only support the pilot, but that's going to be the charging infrastructure for the two Gilligs we get later this year. But also that will allow us to get five additional buses next year, as we agreed on the last board meeting. Also, as part of the pilot, we were accepted into SDG&E's Power to Drive, part of their SB 350 program. That's going to help us offset the infrastructure costs associated with it. And then in the drawing or the picture you see below, that's the overhead gantry system that we're going to use from a scalable approach for our ZEB. And as mentioned before, we successfully completed our roadmap and our transition study and submitted our rollout plan to CARB. So I'm going to turn it over to Wayne, and he's going to go over our rail aspect.
Good morning, Chair Fletcher and members of the board. Well, despite our COVID-19 break in the fourth quarter, we had a fairly productive year in fiscal 20. Starting with our master concessionaire services program, we have a master concessionaire who secures vendors to provide retail services on our station platform as well as advertising. And you can see this is a recurring revenue stream that continues to populate every year. We did have one down year in 18, but that was as a result of a loss of a lucrative advertising contract that year. But it's still going with pretty good steam. Our special event statistics for last year, we did have a COVID impact there. Typically, we have about 200 events annually. We were down to 122. Certainly, we had Comic-Con, where we see 30,000 less riders. We didn't really notice that on the trains, and we think that if there was actually the less ridership had to do with the build-out of the venue throughout several blocks in the Gas Lamp Quarter, which would typically maybe result in fewer trips coming in and out of the venue. This I want to highlight this flood that occurred in December 6th, and I realize that's the previous fiscal year. This was in a report that we were going to submit to the board, but that the operating report was waived that year. This was the worst flood we've had. The our yard and this building is at the low point in downtown San Diego. All the storm drains flow to us. The storm drains go out through the Schweitzer Creek Channel, which is positioned underneath our rail yard into San Diego Bay. When we have a high tide and a heavy rain, we get flooding. What caused further problems this past year, in this particular case, was we had the homeless center that's set up on Newton Avenue immediately adjacent to this facility, and the water came in through the east end of our C facility shop. That's never happened before, and we think that may have had to do with some of the drains and the change in water flow because of the homeless center. There was also a series of 14 porta potties that were adjacent to our facility that turned over, and much of the water that rushed into this facility was contaminated. What you're looking at here is a pit that's 8 feet deep. That's a new state-of-the-art wheeled terrain machine, a $1.8 million wheeled terrain machine that was a complete loss. A new one is scheduled to be implemented or scheduled to be installed by hopefully December of this year as a replacement. But we never did get rid of our old one, so it's been able to get us by over the past couple of years. Just another picture. This is another shop, 8 feet deep pit. This is what our platform looks like downstairs when these kinds of conditions occur. We have three tracks and three platforms here. This is an employee carrying a person to safety. Other damages we pumped out over 300,000 gallons of contaminated water, lost our wheel turning machine, lost our in-floor jacks, and a whole host of other equipment. Lost our office spaces were severely damaged. And with all of the other equipment that we lost during this flood, we had about a $4 million hit, although our insurance provider has been making us whole. And with all the problems that we've had at this facility with water over the past 40 years, we kind of wonder what's next and if we're ready for it. It's hard to overstate the importance of a solid annual capital program. It's imperative that we maintain our systems in a state of good repair. There is currently a $140 billion backlog of state of good repair projects related to the infrastructure of rail systems nationwide. The MTS capital program invested $700 million between 2009 and 2015 to bring our system into a 100% state of good repair. The blue line from downtown to the U.S.-Mexican border at San Ysidro is arguably the most productive light rail line segment in North America today. A major portion of the multi-year trolley renewal program was a complete rebuild of the blue line. All new overhead catenary system with a more robust wire, new track ties ballast, 32 newly constructed grade crossings, all new stations and transit centers, new station platforms, shelters, furniture, and parking lots, a new signaling system with new automatic crossover track switches for greater operational efficiency, new next train information technology signage, and additional passenger conveniences were implemented system-wide. And enhancements were made to the San Ysidro freight yard, and signaling improvements for more flexible nighttime freight operations were made. All other stations on the system received newly designed station shelters, station furniture, and modified boarding platforms to accept low-floor boarding. And 65 new Siemens low-floor rail cars were procured to provide service system-wide. At the conclusion of this very aggressive project that we call the trolley renewal, the Federal Transit Administration acknowledged that our system was now in a 100% state of good repair. We're proud of that, and we want to keep it that way. And I would also like to add that considerable credit for this remarkable achievement goes to our then-CEO, Paul Jablonski. He cobbled together the money to put this program possible, and helped see it through from the beginning to the end. Now, the next series of slides I have will reflect the benefits of a good capital improvement program. Our operations control center was refreshed this past year with new state-of-the-art centralized train control monitoring screen. This includes, and at the bottom of it, you can see the bottom line there. It's kind of hard to see, but that's our Midcoast extension. Anybody that would like to have a look at our control center can contact us or Sharon Cooney, and we'd be happy to give a tour. But there was a significant investment here to get ready for Midcoast. This is an additional controller's workstation that will be occupied by the new Midcoast controller. Other projects we have an ongoing parking lot surfacing program. This is Euclid Avenue. We worked with the Army Corps of Engineers. It took 2 years to get a permit to clean the channel, but we got it cleaned. This is at Euclid Avenue Station, and the graffiti you see on the channel here was actually a community program that was done back in March of 1986 when we opened up this station that involved graffiti artists. There's been some talk about redoing this now that the channel's been cleaned. We have an ongoing fencing replacement project. This is Dairy Mart fencing in the South Bay. Sampson Street up here on Harbor Drive, and this is ongoing year-round. We removed the freight tracks at Cleveland Avenue in National City and repaved, as we did in also F Street Chula Vista. We replaced the crossing at 8th Avenue in downtown San Diego, the 65th Street crossing in Encanto, High Street crossing in Lemon Grove, Taylor Street crossing in Old Town, Washington Street at Pacific Highway, Palm Avenue crossing was replaced in El Cajon. We replaced the ballast ties and track over the I-8 bridge in La Mesa. We replaced the Amaya track to our new open design concept, which actually allows our track equipment to get through and surface and align our rail. So this is our new design, and it has passenger pathways where the platform is from one side to another. We did this at Amaya, and we also did it at Grossmont this past year. We put a retaining wall up at Hill Street to guard against erosion in that area. San Ysidro buyer track replacement. This is on the hill. The freight facility is immediately adjacent to it. This is going down to our border station. It's about a quarter of a mile of double track rail ties and ballast that was replaced. Next part of this project will be a retaining wall in the slope. This was initially part of the trolley renewal program. It was about a $5.2 million program, but the project ran out of money, and so now we're funding it out of our CIP. We have an annual rail grinding program. This is a contract piece of equipment that comes in, and it actually grinds the railhead. It prepares the surface, removes the corrugation, adds to the life of the rail and the quality ride quality adds to the life of the rail, the life of the wheel that rides on it, and the ride quality as well. This is what it looks like after it's been ground. We have new traction power substations replacing old ones system-wide. We have 17 new ones that were put on the Midcoast Extension. This is the new Siemens state-of-the-art traction power substation. We procured 45 new light rail vehicles. 36 of these were for the Midcoast operation, and 9 were provided through the TIRCP state cap and trade funding on a grant for service enhancements on the Blue Line and Orange Line. These cars have all been delivered now. We have approximately 40 that have been through full commissioning, and this is the first time we've had all the cars for the line extension here this far in advance, and so we're in pretty good shape for our startup of Midcoast. During the hepatitis A outbreak in 2017, we decided to change our cloth seating to a vinyl seating. Our passengers really appreciated this because on a cloth seating, it's kind of hard to see if you have a soiled surface. So this is what our interior looks like now, but all of our seats are now vinyl. We are also in the process of our San Diego 10 procurement of 47 new Siemens S70 light low floor cars. We're replacing the second generation 2000 series high floor cars. We have some interest from some other rail properties to purchase these cars, and so we may see a bit of a revenue stream from the sale of these in the future. Our facilities department built a new sterile lab in our revenue department for the new Innit ticket vending machines. This is their test lab. And this is actually a new ticket vending machine and a stand-up validator, and you can see it has the new Pronto logo on top of the ticket vending machine. These will be all ready to be put on the system, the existing system, and then we will work with the contractor to also put them on the Midcoast extension when ready. This was a mural that was out at 62nd Street in Canto Station. It was done as part of the trolley renewal by a local artist. You can see it was vandalized. We secured another artist to come in and correct the problem, and we've also charged him with the responsibility of keeping it in good shape. We restored our first LRV, the 1001, which was largely recognized as the start of the light rail renaissance throughout the United States. We kept this car, we completely restored it, it's better than new, and we put it in service last July on our vintage Silver Line. This is an article in Passenger Transport. We were one of the first systems in California to implement our secondary form of protection for roadway workers. There was a couple of fatalities up at BART in the Bay Area of roadway workers. The Public Utilities Commission came out with a mandate for a secondary form of protection. We have this implemented. It works very well. We've had very solid policies and procedures to protect roadway workers, and in 40 years we've never had an incident, but this allows another layer of protection to make certain that we do not. We're working diligently with our with the contractors in Sandag. This is the Midcoast portion of the Midcoast Extension. This is the Old Town looking north. Between Old Town and the Santa Fe Depot, it's been re-signaled. We've had additional traction power substations. We're putting in additional crossovers in that area. We'll be putting certainly the UC San Diego Blue Line over this line segment, so there'll be two lines operating over it. This is the track work that was done underneath the I-8 area. It's called the Friars Junction underneath the viaduct. The track work that goes off to the right is the green line going to Mission Valley, and going straight, we'll take our UC San Diego Blue Line trains up to La Jolla. This is readiness for operations activities. This is our operational readiness committee. It's comprised of MTS operations, maintenance, Sandag, the contractors, and the Sandag's consultant. This will be our 10th service expansion since 1981. We have quarterly meetings with the FTA and the FTA's project management oversight consultant and other stakeholders. We have monthly readiness meetings now with the PMOC. The MTS Rail System Safety Manager serves as Sandag's safety and security manager for the Midcoast project. The Rail Activation Committee, established in 2019, will provide appropriate oversight for a seamless transition from construction to revenue service operations. Two years ago, the board approved 85 additional positions. This is a mix of new hires and promotions, 32 of which are technical positions, all of whom have been hired or in the apprenticeship program. Most will be scheduled to graduate before startup. We have four train operator classes scheduled that will be conducted back-to-back to support operations on this line extension. We have 36 light rail vehicles commissioned and ready to go. Our testing and systems integration protocols are in place. Our operating service schedule has been developed. Our training schedules have been developed for all personnel. All operating and maintenance policies and procedures have been identified and drafted. All appropriate field signage for this extension has been identified and ordered. And MTS is likely to assume authority of this extension in July of next year for pre-revenue operations. At that time, all ongoing construction activity, operations, maintenance, and security will fall under MTS control. Mike Weigant did a good job of talking about our COVID response. Just a couple of other things. We have 56 hand washing stations positioned at all of our stations and transit centers. And the next two slides were presented at the FTA Midcoast Quarterly Meeting and illustrate the MTS Clean Ride campaign and are fairly self-explanatory. The signage depicted on the slides are generously posted on station platforms and on our trains. Important to note that the cleaning protocols we established during the 2017 Hep A outbreak for our trains, stations, and other passenger equipment is what the CDC recommended for COVID-19 response. Since we never discontinued this cleaning protocol, it remained in effect when COVID-19 hit and really placed MTS in a good position to get ahead of things. We have since assigned additional personnel at key transit centers to clean exterior door buttons as trains arrive. Our patrons have appreciated this. We have deployed ambassadors at various stations system-wide to provide face masks to patrons who may be in need of one. Germ barriers, as Mike indicated, have been installed at all check-in points where every employee is required to record their temperature. We also make appropriate PPEs available to all staff members. We also follow the guidance rules put out by the CDC and other agencies, and we participate regularly on APTA and FTA webinars so we can stay abreast of the most current COVID-19 best practices. And that concludes my comments, and all three of us are available for any questions that you may have. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you both. I know Councilmember Montgomery, I believe, has some comments on this item, and we will go to her first and then any other board members who have comments.
Thank you, Chair. Just very brief comments. I want to thank Mr. Desmond, Mr. Weigand, and Mr. Terry for this presentation. Very hard to consolidate all of this for us especially with a year like this. So really appreciate it. Also want to acknowledge the work that has been done in my city district that was a part of this presentation, such as the Euclid Avenue station channel, the parking lot being repaved, the 62nd and Imperial Street murals, and the track crosswalk on 65th and Imperial. I do just want to highlight, though, acknowledging the challenges that we have, budgetary challenges and such during this time in the backlog, that we do have a track that runs in the middle of our community between Imperial and Aikens, and it has a few crosswalks at 69th and Imperial, at 60th and Imperial, that are still in the condition that you saw the 65th was. Actually, I think only one is in that condition. And also, we do not have a lot of bus pads and bus shelters. So we have some challenges still, and I want to acknowledge the work that has been done, and also, you know, acknowledge what we are hearing from our constituents. So thank you for all of this, and I look forward to getting some additional repairs and clearing that backlog.
Thank you. Thank you, Councilmember Montgomery. Any other board member comments or questions? All right. Hearing none, I want to thank the staff for the great report and all the great work. This is certainly a cumulative look at everything that we're doing and very important to us as an organization. It is 10:52. What I think we will do is Sharon, let's have you do item 47. Give a quick update. This should take us about 15 minutes on this. And I think what we'll do is waive presentation on item 48. It's a report. It's available. If any board members have any questions, we can certainly address those, or if folks want to walk through that, we can consider doing that at our next board meeting. But I think we'll get through item 47, and then we will move into closed session. Again, we have three quick items in closed session, but things that are time sensitive, we have to do this meeting. So Sharon, why don't you take away item 47? Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm just going to go quickly through this. I gave you a very lengthy explanation within the report that you have in your agenda packet. So I do want to highlight some things about our fairs before I get into our SDM eligibility program. These are the fairs that we have on our system. We've tried to keep it as simple as possible, but as you notice, there's a steep discount for those who are eligible due to a disability or senior age or youth. So it is a good program that the board has offered to our customers, and so it's a very valuable benefit. Just to highlight how important fair revenue is for MTS, in fiscal year 2019, we actually had $92.2 million in operating revenue for that year. It gave us a fare box recovery of about 32%. It's very important to MTS to have this fair revenue. In a comparison, and you can see this in Attachment A, our fare box recovery rate is higher, much higher than our peers, which have an average of about 18.4%. So a very big part of our operating budget is paid for by the riders. The riders are sensitive to any fare changes that increase their costs because, for the most part, they are in the low to middle income range for their household incomes. 84% of our riders live in households with incomes below $50,000. So one other thing that to note is in fiscal year 2020, with the pandemic, we have seen a pretty sharp decline in the household incomes of our customers as well. So it's very important for us to make sure that as we look at fares, that we're making sure that we're attaining an equity across the board. Riders' dependency rates are also fairly high compared to our peers. This shows you that more than half of our riders have no other option except for taking transit. Most of our passengers take advantage of our pass programs because these offer the best value for the cost. But I will mention to you that a large portion of our riders do enjoy the benefits of the lower cost program. 38% of them are either riding free because they're under six, or they're paying the significantly discounted fare, which is about 68% of the cost of a normal adult fare. 7% of our transit riders are seniors, and then 17% of them are not employed or retired. So you can look at the equity of the fares based on what percentage of fare revenue is coming from which type of pass. And you can see that more than half of our revenue is coming from those who are paying for the adult full fare. The SDM fare and the youth fare, those are significantly discounted. And so those riders are enjoying their ridership for much less of a cost, and therefore they're contributing less to the operating budget. So I wanted to mention to you that we changed the procedures we use to get a reduced fare in our system and become eligible for the senior disabled Medicare or youth passes. We changed it in April of 2011, because we were interested in taking advantage of the new Compass Card technology, which allowed us to put a picture on the Compass Cards for those who really didn't want to have to carry around another form of identification. We really streamlined the approval process. We did a lot of outreach. Really, our goal with this new process was to preserve the benefit for those who truly qualify. Again, I wanted to highlight that it's a 68% discount off of the regular adult fare. Over time, we've changed the process and the applications to reflect the feedback we've gained from stakeholders, customers, medical providers, social service agencies, et cetera. And we've also had some changes made by the Social Security Administration, which we kind of mirror our eligibility for the disability side of that program. Individuals may still purchase or use a discounted pass without a Compass Card. They just need to show one of these other forms of identification, whether it's their proof of their age, Social Security card, Medicare card, DMV placard, et cetera. But then there are two other ways you can get the Compass ID card. 90 to 94% of applicants will use the short form. That's a form that is very easy to fill out. They fill it out, they bring it into the transit store, they can get a picture on a card. All they have to show is their other forms of eligibility, proof of eligibility that I had just mentioned. Anyone without one of those forms of proof can obtain the Compass Card by having a medical provider certify their eligibility using the long form. So once approved, they get a picture put on the Compass Card at the transit store, just like anyone using the short form. In a typical year, we will sell 9,000 to 10,000 Compass IDs. This might be somebody replacing an ID that they lost, or it could be a brand new individual coming into the store for the first time. You can also be certified to purchase discounted passes on Compass Cloud, which is our mobile ticketing source. This just gives you a snapshot of how many of these are coming in, whether it's the long or the short form, on a monthly basis. And then I did want to mention we recently changed the form based on some feedback we received and also some changes in the SSA list of acceptable medical sources. So now we are allowing licensed physician's assistants and nurse practitioners to certify in all the categories in which they are licensed to diagnose. We also removed a narrative box for medical providers to explain how a particular disability impacts the applicant's ability to use transit. We got feedback that this was considered confusing by providers, and that certainly wasn't the intent of that particular narrative box. So we have removed that. And with that, I'll answer any questions. And I do want to note to you that we've included several forms of to get certification for eligibility of discounted programs at other transit agencies, and that's in your attachments.
Thank you, Sharon, for that. Any Any comments, questions from board members? All right, seeing none, unless there's a strong objection, I think we'll waive presentation on item 48. That's certainly available to all board members. And if someone wants to bring it back in a future meeting, we're certainly happy to bring it back. With that, I think we are going to move into closed session. It should not take us long. We'll give about a five. Oh, wait, we had one public speaker. I don't know if they're still here.
Yes, they're logged on.
Yes, let's do that before.
Okay, Janelle Sistine, we will unmute you now. Janelle, I think you need to unmute your mic.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hi, everybody. My name's Janelle Sisting. I'm a local business owner. I've got 20 employees in Pacific Beach, and I own a business called Lotus and Luna. I wanted to give you guys a little insight into what it's been like in the business community in Pacific Beach recently. So throughout the pandemic, we've seen our neighbors closing up shop for good. The boxing gym, the ice cream shop, and the dance studio, all on our one block, closed permanently, representing 40% of the businesses on this block closing. These were the spots that created a community here. In the past few months, we've also seen a fire and a break-in at the closed business next door. We've seen human feces and homeless people sleeping in the parking lot because half the block was closed. Did any of you have a chance to see the photos attached of all the empty businesses in PB, as well as the fire that occurred during the shutdown? These images are powerful, and they really illustrate the problem I've described above. How can we live and work like this in Pacific Beach? And really, what can we do to create an environment where businesses can thrive and the public can feel safe walking around? We look at other communities as role models, and we have been closely watching Little Italy. We recently surveyed businesses there, and they are currently experiencing a 3 times higher level of customers and revenue than pre-pandemic. They are still able to adhere to social distancing and face mask guidelines. They essentially created an outdoor public market by shutting down the streets on the weekends. Recently, buses were rerouted in downtown to create an open-air walking street for businesses. This was huge. Now there's actually a precedent to move MTS bus routes to create a walking street because they already did it in downtown. I ask you to apply this precedent to Pacific Beach. I urge you to open the streets up, provide the permitting necessary for businesses to move outside, and to create an environment for the public to feel safe walking around. I ask you to immediately close down Garnett to cars to create a walking street like Little Italy before there's no businesses left to save. Nathan Fletcher and MTS representatives, will you stand with us and support local businesses? Will you create a safe environment for businesses to thrive in Pacific Beach? Can we create a walking street on Garnett by November 1st? Can we set a goal date of November 1st to close Garnett to cars and open it up to walking? I've also talked to quite a few businesses and just people walking around Pacific Beach about what they think of this idea. They've brought up the fact that due to all the drunk drivers in Pacific Beach, they don't feel comfortable sitting halfway in the street or on the sidewalk like the businesses are doing right now. And if you actually close down the street to traffic, people would come out and they would love to walk around Pacific Beach and shop. But the way you have it set up right now isn't safe and it's not benefiting the business community. Will you help us? Thank you so much for your time. Janelle.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for those comments. Okay, that concludes our agenda items for today. We will now recess into closed session. We'll give about 5 minutes for everyone to transition over into closed session. So thank you all very much.
So reporting out of closed session, item 24A, closed session conference with real property negotiators regarding 8733 Cuyamaca Street in Santee. The board received a report and gave instructions to negotiators. And on item 24B, closed session conference with real property negotiators regarding the property located at 6645 Imperial Avenue in the city of San Diego. The board received a report from staff and gave instructions to real property negotiators.
That concludes today's meeting. The meeting is now adjourned.